On this week's 51%, it's time to interest more girls in coding.
Today in America, tween girls decide what's cool and what's not cool. And they've decided that coding is not cool or not something that they want to do. And so we do have to make it cool. We do have to make it interesting.
And a new book and video game feature a previously atypical girl. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
So stow your expectations. No, I won't fix your PC. And I don't mind being underrated or ignored. The world is much too interesting to entertain ennui. And I won't ever play it cool. So I won't ever once be bored. Oh, I have been a nerd since long before anyone heard that fair and scrawny was the latest.
Is embracing risk and failure something to which we should all aspire? Reshma Sajani, founder of Girls Who Code, says absolutely. During her race as the first Indian-American woman to run for U.S. Congress, a race she did not win, Sajani visited local schools and saw the gender gap in computing classes firsthand, which led her to start Girls Who Code, now on track to becoming the largest pipeline of future female engineers in the United States. Sajani also has served as deputy public advocate for New York City and promotes a new model of female leadership focused on mentorship and sponsorship and charting your own course. Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, invited Reshma Sajani to share why it is so critical for our society that girls learn to code.
One of the TV shows I've been loving this year is Silicon Valley. It takes every stereotype of the tech culture and makes unrelenting, cringe-inducing fun of it. But if you watch the show, you'll notice that its bro culture of programming feels pretty accurate. Only about a quarter of computer professionals are women, and that's actually down from 1990 when it was at 36%. Girls Who Code is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to change all that by closing the gender gap in computer science. Founded in 2012 by Reshma Sajani, the program is on track to educate more than 40,000 girls in all 50 states this year. Her goal? 1 million women in computer science by 2020. And we'll need them. In less than 10 years, the United States will have 1.7 million jobs for engineers and computing professionals. Without girls, we will literally not have enough qualified people to fill these jobs. Welcome, Reshma.
Hi, how are you?
I want to start with a definition of what it means to code.
Sure. So I would say in its simplest definition, coding is telling a computer what to do or telling a machine what to do.
Now, why is it important to have more female coders for our society?
I believe that coding in the 21st century is going to be a basic skill set, like reading and writing. And when you have women who are half of the student body in college, right, half of those in the labor force, 40% of all breadwinners, and most of these jobs, you know, like, for example, 71% of jobs in STEM are in computer science, and they pay a pretty good salary, right, a great salary. So if we don't have women as part of these jobs from an economic perspective, we're losing out. And I think a lot of these jobs are innovative, right? They're solving the problems of today and tomorrow, whether it's cancer or climate change, or they're building the next generation companies that that we use on social media, like Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. And if you don't have women as part of this growth, we're missing out.
Do you think that girls code different things or solve different problems than boys do?
I mean, I think that, like, for, you know, studies show that 74% of girls want to pick a profession that's about changing the world. So I do think that girls are thinking about their community and their world and how to make it better. So maybe their mom's obese or their brother's dyslexic, right? Or they were bullied in school or they walked past a homeless person and they want to figure out how to get them access to food. I do think that intuitively we are problem solvers and we're community oriented and we're change agents. And so I think that we'll see that as women get more access to technical skills, they're going to use those skills to solve problems.
What are some examples of what girls in your program have used technology to do?
Gosh, everything. So some of my favorite, one of our first girls, she was 16 and she built an algorithm to help detect whether a cancer is benign or malignant. We had a girl, Jasmine, I think in two programs ago, she built an app called Wacky Words to help people in her community who didn't have access to, you know, expensive SAT tutors to learn SAT words. We had two girls, Sophie and Andy, who built a game called Tampon Run to fight against the menstruation taboo, because every girl gets her period, right? And many girls across the world will drop out of school when they do get their period, but we don't talk about it. So they built a really fun game called Tampon Run to just bring attention, right, and awareness to this issue.
So it's actually available in the App Store?
It is. Download it now.
Forget Candy Crush. We're going on a tampon run.
It's totally addictive. I do play it, I will admit, all the time.
Are you tracking the girls who graduate from your programs to see if they're continuing with their project or going into an engineering or computing field?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the problem from an education perspective is just 1 out of 10 American schools offers computer science. And only 25,000 kids took the APCS exam, and less than 4,000 of them were girls. In 3 states, Mississippi being one of them, no girls took the CS exam. And a Google study showed that if, you know, 39% of girls will, if they don't take CS when they're in high school, they're not going to take it in college. And so you got to start building that pipeline much earlier than in college if you want to change the number of women in technology. And so for us, it's really about how do we measure and evaluate the success of our programs and building that pipeline. And so we spend a lot of resources on really smart people who do that. And what we have found is in our summer programs, about 90% of our girls are going on to major or minor in computer science, and 77% were not going to before Girls Who Code. And the number for our clubs girls is about, you know, in the 70s. So our results are incredible, right? And show you that high school is not too late to change what girls think they want to do with their lives. And when you show them what computer science is and what they can do and create and build when they have coding skills, it really opens up their mind and their world to what they think they want to do with their life. So we're absolutely tracking them. And I think the other kind of opportunity that we see is that even once women get into college, when they're in computer science, about half of them will drop out. And so our question is like, if you build a community of girls and we introduce girls to one another, they have support, they can lean on each other, they can learn to be brave with one another, can you reduce that attrition rate? And as Girls Who Code grows, I mean, we've only been around for, you know, 6 years. And so our numbers of girls in college are growing, 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 because we're growing about 300% every year. And so we're excited to see the effect that Girls Who Code is also going to have on not just building the pipeline, but the attrition rate once they're in.
Yeah, because I've read that the number, as of today, 2016, that the number of female engineers graduated from college in an engineering job is actually going down.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So do you have a kind of a ramp timeline that you figured out where you expect to see an impact from your programs? You've got very ambitious goals, right?
Yeah, 1 million girls by 2020. And that's where we came up with that number. We backed end into the jobs that are open and what it would take to get parity. And so, you know, assuming that not all of our girls are going to stick with it, we really came to a conclusion that if we taught 1 million girls by 2020, we could get to parity. You know, it's funny that you say that the number of women are going down. I think it's because the number of men who are opting to go into engineering and computer science is going up.
Right, because it's a percentage. You're right.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, we had McKinsey actually did a lot of this research for us. And what they found is that the number of men opting into computer science in 2011 grew dramatically, but the number of women stayed the same. And I always say that it's because of the social network, right? The social network came out and you learned about Mark Zuckerberg and all guys said, wow, I want a $100 billion exit. You know, how do I do that when I'm in college? And that same impact, that same motivation of trying to build a big company and make a lot of money didn't make a difference for women, right? It wasn't the thing that motivated them. And so that's really a lot of the work that we're doing is, you know, how do we get girls excited about coding and see it as something that they want to do with their lives?
You can do all the training you can, which will increase the number of girls that have the skill set that will increase the likelihood of them actually going into it for college and then for a career. But barriers like stereotypes of what a coder looks like or acts like, you know, like you mentioned the movie The Social Network, or just simply cultural fit at work. How will your programs potentially affect those challenges?
Well, we've really decided in 2016 to really attack culture. And so, you know, we've been doing a lot of work. You know, we did a collaboration with Nickelodeon on a show that they have called Game Shakers. And so that will be really interesting. We just released these videos almost like a spoof, right, on why girls can't code because they get their period, they have boobs, and they have long eyelashes. And in less than 48 hours, it got 1 million views. And one of the interesting things when you look at the comment section is that girls are saying, well, what's coding, right? And so we're really thinking about interesting, provocative ways to get girls interested in this and to really shape culture and to tell the media, like, we're watching you, right? And we're going to pay attention to what you put on your television shows and in your movies. And we're going to make sure that girls are represented because you can't be what you cannot see. And, you know, it's funny, in the 1970s, only 10% of doctors and lawyers were women. And now that number is over 50%. And when I think about why I was inspired to be an attorney, it was because I was, you know, 13 or 14 and I saw Kelly McGillis on The Accused, in this movie Accused, and I thought she was awesome. And the impact of LA Law and Grey's Anatomy and Kelly McGillis, right? You, in the 80s and 90s and in 2000, you were constantly inundated with these smart, you know, beautiful, interesting women who were doctors and lawyers, and little girls said, yeah, me too. And the opposite thing is happening in technology. You know, from the 80s, you have Weird Science and Revenge of the Nerds, right? And War Games to, you know, Silicon Valley or, you know, on HBO today. And you have this myth of a programmer wearing a hoodie, you know, sitting in a basement somewhere. He hasn't showered and he's drinking a Red Bull. And little girls look at him and be like, you know, not only do I not want to be him, I don't even want to be friends with him, right? And so they're opting out because they don't see themselves in the reflection of these, quote, you know, coders and entrepreneurs in media.
That's it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, that these women are beautiful and smart and, you know, doing these careers that girls could now consider because they're seeing them. This question isn't necessarily in, you know, the wheelhouse of girls who code, but what a programmer looks like, you know, does she have to be beautiful?
No, she can be whoever she wants. And I think that's the point. But we have definitely presented what a programmer looks like. And it's not a woman. And he's not social, right? And it's not seen as a collaborative job. And it's not seen as something cool. I mean, listen, you got to meet girls where they're at. And the reality is today in America, tween girls decide what's cool and what's not cool. And they've decided that coding is not cool or not something that they want to do. And so we do have to make it cool. We do have to make it interesting.
Do you think boys and men should feel threatened by this potential onslaught of coding women?
It's funny. You know, no. I always think, because I speak to a lot of male audiences, and I'm like, you know, they're clapping, but are they really crying inside? You know, because if this works, like, it changes things for them, right? See, I think that there's this generation of men, like my husband. My husband majored in computer science. He's an entrepreneur. And, you know, they're not going to put up with it. You know, they're not going to put up with the fact that their daughter can't be whatever she wants to be. And I think that they want a more inclusive world for her, too.
How much have you engaged the tech companies in this mission? Are they on board?
Oh, full-fledged partners. You know, I always feel like, you know, Girls Who Code's not, we're a nonprofit, but it's not charity. You know, we're trying to solve a business problem for them. And we're building the pipeline for them. And that's why, you know, we have over 100 corporate partners. We're running 78 summer immersion programs, hundreds, and probably at this point, thousands of tech employees either volunteer in some way, shape, or form for Girls Who Code at clubs or in summer programs. And for them, it's like, you know, Microsoft, IBM, you know, AT&T, Twitter, you know, Facebook, they've been with us for several years. And they've doubled tripled the programs that they're hosting at their office. Like, they've reaped massive benefits, not just, you know, in potentially building a pipeline of young women that they will go on to hire as interns and as full-time employees, but for their employees, right? Retention of women is a huge issue for many of these companies. And so what better way to show your commitment than to have a Girls Who Code program on site and having your employees participate in mentorship and sponsorship of them?
What do you think makes for a good coder? I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that you feel like it should be something that's taught, like reading and writing and reading, writing, arithmetic, right? So with coding, does it take a special skill? Do you have to have an affinity? Anyone can learn it?
I think anyone can learn it. Honestly, like, I, you know, a lot of coding is, it's computational thinking. It's logical thinking. It's how to solve a problem. You don't have to be good at algebra or math to be good at coding. And, you know, I was a lawyer. I think lawyers are probably going to be great coders, right? Because that's, you know, you're thinking about logic games, you're thinking about process and, you know, how do you solve something and how do you talk your way through a solution? And that's a lot of what coding is. I also just feel like, you know, it's about being comfortable, right? Because technology is going to be a part of everything we do. And again, because of that perfection thing, if we're not comfortable with a topic, we're going to stay away from it. So we might have a great business idea and every business idea is going to have a technical component, but we may be afraid to start our company because we're afraid to really converse with engineers because we think that they're going to have some knowledge we don't have. So even being able to know enough that you can talk with a technical person is really important.
What's the best advice that you've been given about initiating change?
Just to do it. I think sometimes we overthink things. And I think with Girls Who Code, if I had overthought it, if that idea didn't come to me at a certain moment in time where I was a little bit like, F it, you know, I've been through so much, I'm just going to build and create. And I had gone through the experience at age 33 of like building over $1 million campaign. I don't think I ever would have done it. And so people always say to me, I have this idea, that idea. I'm like, great, just try it. Just start it. Like, build a pilot.
Rashma, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That was Rashma Sajani, founder of Girls Who Code, speaking with Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW.
But you don't really know me, and my culture don't control me. So don't you pigeonhole me, cause my face is set to stun. I've been a nerd since long before I could have heard that bookish girls should look and act a certain way.
Song of the Deep, a new video game by Insomniac Games, is hitting a frequently untapped market when it comes to children. A book produced in parallel with the game tells the story of a young girl named Merin, who builds a submarine to venture into open water in search of her father, who one stormy night at sea never returned. 51%'s Patrick Garrett spoke with author and co-founder of Insomniac Games, Brian Hastings, in part about what he's done to help encourage young girls.
What is the difference between writing the book and writing for a video game?
I think maybe the biggest difference is that books and games have very different strengths. What I really love about video games is it's about discovering a world, and we like making new worlds, fantastic worlds. But the best part is that as a player, you get to go in and discover it and find out its mysteries on your own. And the best part about books, I think, is they let you get deeper into the characters. You get to see sides of the characters that would just never come about in a video game where you're playing as the character. You don't connect as much, you don't get as in-depth with them. So I think the book allows you to see a lot more of, in this case, Merin and her life, and see it through her eyes, what her thoughts are, what she's like.
Now, Marin's the child in the book, and it's told from her perspective. She actually builds a submarine in it. Is there a reason why you chose a small child, a girl, versus a, say, a boy?
Merin is inspired by my daughter. Actually, she's a character I created in order to inspire my daughter, because when my daughter was around 9, she would tell me a lot about the characters that she liked, and she likes to write her own stories. But when she would read a book or see a movie with a female protagonist, she tended to tell me about the characters, and the first thing she would always say is how pretty they were. And that just got me thinking about how in games and in movies, the heroines are always beautiful, and that's, I think kids tend to zero in on that and just associate that as being the most important thing, or at least very important to the character. And I wanted to create a hero that represented the qualities that I wanted my daughter to admire about herself, a hero that was only heroic because of her actions, of her inner qualities, that she's intelligent, she's creative, she's kind. You know, that's what gets her through the journey.
So I take it your daughter's interested in science field?
She is. She's really into science, yeah.
Do you encourage it within your own home?
We do. I mean, yeah, we really try to foster, like, anything she likes. She's very artistic, and she likes writing as well. But she loves science in school, and so we try to, you know, we go to museums, and we watch, you know, science shows, and like anything we can to, you know, just to keep her excited about the things that she's interested in.
Well, now, people often say that kids aren't interested in reading anymore. People are always interested in video games, that interactiveness, even with the advent of Pokemon Go, the brand new app taking over the world right now. What would make a kid want to pick up the book?
I I think kids have really, I mean, a lot of parents have told me that their kids have read it and have told me how they've reacted to it. And I think for both boys and girls, it's a character who you can relate to because, one, when she's vulnerable and what she's doing is all out of love for her father. So it's about the lengths that we go to help people we love. But also she's all on her own throughout it. She doesn't have any help. So it's a story about kids being independent and having to overcome extreme adversity and seemingly impossible challenges all on their own. So it does have the fantasy of discovery and just kind of like an incredible world that she finds down there below the sea. But it's also a world where she doesn't have anyone helping her. She doesn't have a mentor character. She doesn't have a parent. She doesn't have anyone who's going to solve the problems for her. And I think that's something that, you know, kids can identify with their own challenges that they go through when sometimes they feel like they're on their own and are having to overcome something.
What makes you want to put this story, I mean, both video game-wise and book-wise, in the sea with sea monsters?
We had an idea we actually had three different pitches for submarine games, and there was something that just resonated with that. But for me personally, I've always been kind of fascinated with the idea that there's something magical that's just out of sight, something that could really exist. And the book and the game are both filled with magical realism. So it's intended to be a world that could be our world. It's not, you know, it's not an alien planet. It's not a pure fantasy setting. It's intended to be that this could be real, but at the same time, there are elements that feel fantastic, but are accepted by the characters as being real things, as being things that are just naturally part of the world. So I think the whole idea, you know, that there actually could be something down in the depths, something that's yet undiscovered, is just kind of fascinating. I think it's something that we kind of share. It's, as a kid, I used to dream of you know, my bed being a submarine, of going exploring the depths. I'm just thinking that, you know, there's something still out there that, you know, we could discover. There's something that we haven't found yet, and, you know, maybe I'm going to be the one to find it.
The inspiration behind the title, both the game and the book, the Song of the Deep, how does that come to be?
It's based on Maren's father would sing her songs, lullabies about the mysteries that are down there, and the theme of songs plays out throughout the whole story. Like when she dives down and she finds these stones that resonate with this melodic hum, which is the same tune as one of her father's lullabies. A lot of mysteries that are tied into songs and where the songs came from and what they mean. There's a deeper mystery that gets uncovered throughout the course of the game and the book that's all related to songs.
This is primarily a children's book. It's aimed at children. But, you know, as an adult myself, both reading and playing video games, I find myself captivated by a lot of these younger tales. Do you have any books or games you'd compare it to?
There are a lot of stories that affected me when I was growing up. And my first one that really made a difference was The Neverending Story.
I read
that one by Michael Ende. Really, I mean, it was such a beautiful, magical world of discovery. And also, like, deeply sad in certain parts, and I think it had a big effect on me emotionally. I got really angry at the author as I was reading it. I was like, how could he do this in the Swamps of Sorrow? But yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to capture that same kind of discovery and magic on the same kind of strengths of characters, and also the journey that the hero has to go through of it seeming impossible. You don't know, you know, you look at what's ahead of you. At one point, Maren has to get past three impassable lands, and each one is more deadly, and she just has no idea how she's going to do it. And at that point, she had met other characters along the way, but there's no one who can help her. There's no one who can get her past this, and it's just people who are depending on her getting through. I think I had that same feeling as I was reading Neverending Story. I think I was 10 when I first read it. And so I think... In some ways, I've wanted to create a similar feeling in a book and in a game.
That was author and co-founder of Insomniac Games, Brian Hastings, speaking with 51%'s Patrick Garrett. Making it up in our secret world. Shaking it up. Breaking it up. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1413.